Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Groundfish Framework 45. We're going to have a PowerPoint presentation from Ann, which I think is document number 7, and we have number 6 for the decision document. We have a series of motions. Actually, I think there's 11 motions. We're going to group a couple of them when we can. When we do get to the motions, some of them are committee motions, some aren't. But I'm going to ask for a second on all of them just to make sure they're clear because of the way they were grouped and two minor changes. I just want to make sure that that's clear now. Ann's going to do the presentation. She'll stop at appropriate times, and then we'll do the motions for that section. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Ann.
Hey, this is the final action on Framework 45. I'm going to do the presentation in three parts here. We have the document grouped in the three parts as shown on the screen. The first section of the document is updates to status determination criteria, formal rebuilding programs, and annual catch limits. And under that, we have revised status determination criteria for pollock, revised Georges Bank yellowtail flounder rebuilding mortality targets, ACL specifications, U.S.-Canada resource sharing understanding tax, and the yellowtail flounder allocations for the scallop fishery, which we are going to vote on today because we didn't take final action on that yesterday at the scallop discussion. The second part of the document, so I'm going to present those first 5 points, and then we're going to take time for motions, and then we'll move on to the second section, motions again, and then move on to the third section here. The second section will be fishery program administration, and under that we have implementation of additional sectors, monitoring requirements for hand gear A and B permitted vessels and small vessel exemption vessels, monitoring requirements for commercial groundfish vessels, distribution of PSC from canceled permits, and submission of sector rosters. Finally, in the third section, we have a few commercial and recreational fishery measures, which include general category scallop dredge exemption, modification of restrictions for that exemption, Gulf of Maine cod spawning protection area, and hand gear permit management measures. So moving on to the first section, which is the ACLs and status determination criteria. The first item in this section is revised status determination criteria for pollock. This is the council has heard almost, I think, everything in this section before, but just to summarize, we had a new assessment for pollock this year, and no action would keep the numbers from the old pollock assessment, and option two under this measure would adopt a new assessment, which makes 16,200 metric tons of for MSY instead of 11,320, which was what was under the previous assessment. The second item under this section of the document is the revised Georges Bank yellowtail flounder rebuilding mortality targets. The committee did pick a preferred option for this section, which is to rebuild by 2016 with a 50% probability of success. That's option 2A in the document. And the way the options are structured is that option 1 is no action, which would keep the rebuilding strategy to rebuild by 2014 with a 75% chance of rebuilding. And option 2 is to revise the strategy. The sub-option A, which was the preferred, was that to rebuild by 2016 with a 50% chance of rebuilding. Sub-option B was to also rebuild by 2016 with a 60% chance. Sub-option C was the same, but with a 75% chance of rebuilding by 2016. And option D extended the rebuilding timeline out to 2019 with a 60% chance of rebuilding. And to briefly summarize the impacts of this section, we have the full impact analyses are in the draft framework that was distributed to the council. The economic impacts, I put just a portion of the graph we have there of the present value of the revenue stream for the U.S. portion of the TAC for each of the options and the sub-options. A little small up there, but it is in the document and it's been distributed. Option D has the highest present value revenue stream, and then A, B, no action, and C in that order. I also want to point out that there is a decision document that's been distributed, and these are also summarized in the decision document on the second page here under section 4.1.2. And for the biological impacts of the Georges Bank yellowtail rebuilding, all the sub-options under option 2, which are revising the rebuilding strategy, would delay rebuilding from the current schedule. and options A and C would rebuild within the Magnuson-Stevens Act 10-year timeline. Option D extends the timeline beyond the 10 years. I've been advised by the service that that may not be approvable. So option A was the committee preferred option. Section 4.1.3 of the document, we have ACL specifications. The committee did choose a preferred alternative, which is to revise the ACLs, which is option two. I couldn't put the graphs up here because they're too big, but they are in the draft document on page 23 for the no action alternative and page 26 for the option two. This action would revise the ACLs for Georges Bank Cod, Georges Bank Haddock, and Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder under the U.S.-Canada tax, and would also revise Georges Bank Yellowtail under the revised rebuilding strategy if the council chooses to adopt one. It also has revised ACLs for White Hake to correct an error that was in the Federal Register after Framework 44 was published for those numbers. And it would adopt the revised ACL for Pollock based on the new assessment. So it basically just implements all of the new numbers from all of the other actions in this section. Section 4.1.4, we have the U.S.-Canada tax that were recommended this year by the TMGC. The council actually already voted to adopt these tax at the September meeting, so no action is needed on this one unless the council would like to change something about the tax that were adopted. And just to summarize, I put the tables up here to show the total TAC in the U.S. portion of the TAC for fishing year 2011 and the difference from fishing year 2010. Finally, the last section in 4.1 is 4.1.5, and that's the yellowtail flounder allocations for the scallop fishery. It says in the presentation that it was determined yesterday, but that was wishful thinking, I guess. so we do have to take action on this today. The two options that we have based on the scallop discussion yesterday are no action, which would keep the scallop sub-ACLs in terms of weight that were adopted in Framework 44. This is on page 30 of the draft document. And I do want to point out that the numbers that we currently have in the draft document are incorrect because we published an addendum to Framework 44 after the scallop Framework 21 was passed. So the numbers have changed slightly. Under the no action alternative, I can read the correct numbers so everyone has them. For the Georges Bank sub-ACL in 2011, it's actually 201 metric tons, and for 2012, 307 metric tons. So those are only a couple tons different than what's in there. And for the Southern New England Mid-Atlantic stock, or for the sub-ACL, it's 82 metric tons for 2011 and 127 for 2012. So that's what the council would be voting on with an action alternative. The other option in the document on page 30 would be the scallop scenario 1 because that's the one that was adopted yesterday. And those numbers are based on 90% of the expected need for that scallop scenario 1, and those numbers are the third ones down on the chart there. So that's it for the status determination criteria, and we can move on to the motions.
Okay, thank you, Ann. First motion is to adopt option 2, revised status determined criteria for Pollock. 4.1.2, option 2, sub-option A, revised Georges Bank Yellowtail Rebuilding Strategy. And 4.1.3, option 2, and Framework 45, which is the revised ACLs. And I ask for a second.
So you've bundled three committee motions, so we'll ask
correct.
For a second.
So I'd like
is there
to
a second? Seconded by Rick Cunningham. Discussion? Discussion on the motion. Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, just a little explanation, if you would, Frank, regarding the revised Georges Bank Yellowtail-Flounder rebuilding strategy. A is preferred, 2016, at 50% probability. Currently, it's a 75% probability. What was the logic for changing the probability from 75% to 50%?
Probably more fish.
Well, I know, but more fish? Well, in that case, there's the answer.
Frank, did you want to hit that?
I think Jimmy, I'll defer to Jimmy. Oh.
Mary Beth?
Well, as I recall the discussion on Yellowtail, there were some significant concerns about the latest stock assessment and the average recruitment that's assumed. And the most recent average, we're using a long-term average recruitment that is much higher than the more recent 15-year average. And so there was some concern about the ability to rebuild with that probability of success at a higher level.
Jimmy?
Yeah, that was the point I was trying to get at. I'm opposed to this rebuilding strategy. I don't think we can make it even at 50% probability. Again, as Mary Beth pointed out, we would have to believe in the tooth fairy, as one person put it, to think that we're going to get this done. We haven't had recruitment. The recruitment hasn't been there for over 20 years. So we need that. We would have to have 20-year-old recruitment for the next 3 years to make this happen. So I will be opposed to this motion.
Anyone else on the council? David Gaethel.
Yes, at the committee level, we had asked to perhaps have somebody present to present some information on Yellowtail and this issue of low recruitment. Because we as a committee, or at least a number of us, didn't feel, as Jimmy said, that this 2016 is realistic. But we were informed at the committee level that 2019 was most likely unapprovable. So, once again, we're caught between a rock and a hard place here. And I looked through the SSC's report, and that's what I was just doing here for the last 15 minutes, and I can't really find anything that makes a definitive statement other than the fact that it says that in 2011 recruitment should be examined because our recruitment projections are higher than anything we've seen in the last 30 years. I think that's the exact statement that's in the report. So this is a pretty serious issue. My understanding also is that if we approve 2016, we can revisit it sometime between now and then and extend it out if it appears to be unachievable. But that still leaves me with a very uneasy sense that we're basically setting ourselves up to do something that's undoable. So I guess the question is, for people who want to vote on this motion, do you want to do something that's most likely undoable and then try to undo it later on in the future? Or do you want to admit right up front that it's undoable and pick a realistic number, which is probably 2019?
For council members' information, I'll point out behind tab 3, document 5A, is a letter response from Pat Kirkle on this issue. If you haven't read it, I think you should. It clearly lays out the service's perception of I think the alternative that people are talking about, which is the one that extends it out to 2019 at 60%, and their letter says that it's not consistent with National Standard 1, and it lays out the case for that here. It also goes into describing what was done in the North Pacific relative to Opelio, and if you haven't read it, you should take a look at it. Anyone else on the council? Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, regarding the SSC advice, the report that they've provided to us, they do indicate for Georges Bank Yellowtail that The rebuilding target BMSY should be reconsidered by the next benchmark assessment to account for lower recruitment in the last 30 years. So when is the next benchmark assessment scheduled, if it has been, since that suggests that we might end up with a lower BMSY as a consequence of what's going on with recruitment for the last 30 years? So, Mr. Chairman, if I could ask that question of Nancy.
Are you're asking me when the next benchmark assessment is scheduled?
Right, because it seems to me that if it might be in the near future, we could end up with a lower BMSY, which would likely put us in a position of reaching that target sooner rather than later.
Right. I mean, what you're suggesting is that given the history of recruitment, perhaps the reference points could change. And I mean, sure, anything is possible, but at this point, obviously, the assessment that we just completed demonstrated that in the absence of fishing, the rebuilding schedule is achievable. So my guess is that in the next benchmark, we're not going to really show much in terms of a difference.
Surprises me. Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, if you would, I apologize. I haven't read the letter from Pat Kirkle. So would you again, or Pat could, highlight what the service's concerns are regarding this particular motion?
I'll ask Pat to provide Pat's letter to the council. Document 5A behind tab 3. Paul Howard, while we're waiting.
David, in the meantime, benchmark assessments for Georges Bank Yellowtail are done every year with the track. I think those are benchmarks. So we could add TORs about, no? Okay.
Georges Bank Yellowtail Flounder does not appear on the SAS ARC schedule, which goes through December 2013. It's behind tab 1. Every council meeting you have a copy of the SAS ARC schedule for your information. Now to Dr. Pierce's question concerning the letter from Pat Kirkle, I'll turn it over to Pat.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is an October 22nd letter to John. And it specifically addresses the alternative that was included in Framework 45 to go out to 2019, and also the discussion that occurred at the last council meeting about is this where we talked about Apelia? Okay. Sorry. And also the discussion at the last council meeting about the action North Pacific Fishery Management Council had taken with respect to snow crab and some confusion about whether or not that was an extension beyond the maximum 10 years allowed in the Magnuson-Stevens Act. So specifically to Yellowtail, we looked at Framework 42 and Framework 45. And since at this point the scientific advice is that, in fact, Georges Bank Yellowtail can be rebuilt by 2016, and actually important to the issue of the 10 years is whether or not at the beginning of the rebuilding program it could have been rebuilt within 10 years. And that's really the only opportunity for extending it beyond the 10 years if a decision had been made that it could not have been rebuilt within 10 years at the start of the 10-year rebuilding program. And so for Georges Bank Yellowtail, the determination is that it could have been and also that it can be rebuilt by 2016. And so extending out to the 2016 seems to be consistent with the Magnuson Act, but extending to the 2019 is not. with respect to the snow crab fishery. In fact, that at the last council meeting, well, you can see the information that's there. It's a different situation, and it was not an extension beyond the 10 years. So I think that sort of briefly summarizes the letter.
Dr. Pierce.
Just a follow-up. I think it was said by Pat and Nancy that we indeed can rebuild by the deadline if there is no fishing. If fishing mortality is zero, does that mean there would be no scallop fishing in the area because they would be catching yellowtail? So that's, to me, an important consideration. If indeed there is going to be taking of yellowtail in order to allow the scallop fishery in the Georges Bank area, then it seems we will not be able to rebuild, you know, by the current deadline. That would factor into our decision as to whether or not to adopt this motion or something similar to it. Okay.
Pat?
I would suggest that you read the letter. The criteria in the National Standard Guidelines for making a determination about whether or not you're bound by the 10-year requirement is whether or not a stock can rebuild within 10 years in the absence of fishing mortality. So that's the criteria in the National Standard Guidelines. That's not a requirement to reduce fishing mortality to zero. That's how we look at whether or not the 10 years apply. The letter itself talks about what happens in the situation where you don't rebuild. And again, the National Standard Guidelines address that. If the stock does not rebuild by the 2016 deadline, then according to the guidelines, the fishing mortality rate should not exceed F rebuild or 75% of the overfishing rate, whichever is lower. So there's two different things here.
Anyone else on the council? Mark Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Dave Gaither laid out the two choices we have, which is to go with this motion or to insert something else that's not approvable. I think his first option is the way to go, and hope that in a subsequent GRM assessment review that we find have advice that the rebuilding target needs to be lower because of a long-term trend in recruitment to a lower productivity level, and we can react to that. But I don't think we have the only viable alternative, I think, is to go forward with this now and wait to see what the next GARM tells us about productivity of this stock and recruitment.
Thanks, Mark. I think it's important to note there is no more GARM. GARM is dead. And in fact, as I said before, there's no scheduled benchmark for this resource, at least through December 2013, currently.
Well, hopefully somebody will tell us something about yellowtail recruitment patterns and potential for stock rebuilding. Thank you.
Just trying to lay the facts out. I don't want anyone to have expectations that clearly we know won't be met. Anyone else on the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Thirteen. Opposed? One.
Two.
Abstentions? Two. Two in opposition? And one abstention. So 13-2-1. Motion carries. Frank?
Thank you. Next motion to adopt 4.1.5, option number one, no action for yellowtail flounder allocation to the scallop fishery in framework 45, and it's on page 28.
Discussion?
I need a second.
Second? Do I have a second? I need a second, apparently. Seconded by Rip. Discussion?
We thought that was going to come up, as Ann said yesterday, under the scallop discussion, but it didn't. So.
Discussion on the motion. Rip Cunningham.
Just a question. Does it need to indicate as amended with the changes that were pointed out?
Ann? Ann's saying yes.
That would help just to be clear that it's the numbers that I just read rather than the ones that are currently printed on the table on page 30.
As, I guess, Karen, I should say as amended with the table on page 30 of the document.
Okay, discussion from the council. Jimmy?
Yeah, I'm in favor of this motion. I think we had this discussion yesterday. All right. Okay.
Anyone else? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Last chance. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? Abstentions? One abstention. Let's do it over. If you're sitting at the table, you need to vote.
Okay.
One more time. All those in favor, raise your hand. Fifteen in favor. No votes. Abstentions. One abstention. 15-01. Frank, help.
Okay, we're going to go back to Ann. We're all set on that section. We'll go on to some more PowerPoint.
Moving on to Section 4.2 of the document, which is Fishery Program Administration, and Section 4.2.1, which is the implementation of additional sectors. We had seven new sectors proposed in Framework 44, which are listed on page 31 of the draft document. The committee made a motion that the Council will only implement new sectors for which we have operations plans received by the deadline of September 1st, and that motion passed the committee 4-3 with one abstention. It was unclear at the committee whether this motion applied to the state-operated permit banks. The committee discussed that issue, but there was no final guidance for the council on how the committee felt about that. Of the seven new sectors that are proposed, two did submit their operations plans by September 1st, three submitted after, and two did not submit operations plans at all. Of the ones that did submit prior to September 1st, one was the State of Maine Permit Bank and the Sustainable Harvest Sector 3. The three state permit banks did submit operations plans, but not until after September 1st. And then the Northeast Fisheries Sector 14 and the Sustainable Harvest Sector 2 did not submit operations plans to the service. And just to reiterate that most of the proposed sectors or permit banks are inactive sectors. The next section in the document is monitoring for hand gear A, B, and small vessel exemption permits. The option in the document is to have an exemption for dockside monitoring for these permits. I did put tables on here from the affected environment section that summarize hand gear A data so we know how much of the fishery or what portion of the fishery we're talking about. There were 24 permits total in 2009 fishing in hand gear A in Massachusetts. They were all in Massachusetts and in Maine. The total landings and live weight were just under 300,000 pounds in 2009 from the hand gear vessels, and the total revenues were just under $500,000. The groundfish was 37% of the total revenues for these vessels in 2009. And to show down there the total PSC that's held by the hand gear A permits for Gulf of Maine cod and Georges Bank cod, they're both less than 1% of the total PSC for the fishery on those stocks. And the 2010 ACE was about 80,000 pounds for Gulf of Maine cod, about 20,000 pounds for Georges Bank cod that was held by hand gear A permits. For the impacts for this measure, we concluded that it may increase uncertainty, but this is, we're talking about a very minor portion of the total catch here, as shown in this affected environment table. It could account for 15% of the common pool Gulf of Maine cod catch in fishing year 2011 from these hand gear A permits. So even though it's a small amount of the catch, it could be a less small portion of the common pool catch. And this removes the burden of reporting costs for these vessels that land very small amounts of fish, so the cost is particularly high for them as a percentage of revenue. And then moving on to section 4.2.3, which is monitoring for commercial vessels, and there are several options under this measure. Option one is no action. Option two in the document is removal of dockside monitoring in the fishery. We did... Since the draft document went out, we have received some economic impacts analysis, which I'm going to summarize here. The overall cost of the dockside monitoring is estimated at 2 cents per landed pound of groundfish. And for fishing year 2011, the cost of the dockside monitoring program was $281,000, which was 0.4% of the estimated groundfish revenues. That's what's projected for 2011 at the 20% coverage level that's specified in Amendment 16. Eliminating the dockside monitoring may increase uncertainty over landings. And these economic costs are based on invoices that were received from May through August of this year. And these costs could be different when the year is completed, the calculation of these costs. So that's really just an estimate of what the program may cost in 2011. Option three in the document removes the requirement for industry funding for at-sea monitoring in fishing year 2012. It would put the requirement back on the industry in fishing year 2013 to pay for the at-sea monitoring, so it's just for that 1 year. The impacts of that option were somewhat difficult to analyze because they depend on the availability of funding and the ultimate coverage level that would occur if this requirement for industry funding was removed. The Council has been advised by the National Marine Fisheries Service that option three is not approvable. And if lower coverage results because of this option, it could increase discard uncertainty and it could increase risk if the discard estimates were unknown. So there could be an increased buffer that could lower revenue, which may offset the cost of the program. It's from the economic analysis. But it does remove the burden of cost for the industry in fishing year 2012. In the document, we assumed 8% coverage from the observer program and 30% by industry. 8% was the standard that that the agency funded, and 30% by industry, which hits the 38% mark. This year we haven't reached the 38% mark on monitoring, but that's what we projected to calculate costs for fishing year 2012. In fishing year 2010, we have 44% lower trips than on the same date in 2009 as of October 15th. And the average trip was just over 24 hours. So at 30% coverage that would be funded by the industry and figuring a two-day average since the trip was just over 24 hours, at $630 a day, it comes to about $5 million that would be the cost for at-sea monitoring in fishing year 2011, which is about 6% of groundfish revenue. And depending... It could be a higher percent because some of the ACLs are decreasing in future years. Then for option four, in the document maintains the trip and hail requirement if dockside monitoring is removed, because that was initially implemented as part of the dockside monitoring program. But it depends on option two. It's not necessary if option two doesn't go through, but the service believes that it helps with enforcement to know when landings will occur. So there is a suggestion to keep that requirement in there, even if dockside monitoring is removed. In section 4.2.4, The measure is on distribution of PSC from canceled permits. Currently, the PSC from canceled permits is assigned to the common pool because of the way this was described in Amendment 16. So option one would continue with a no action, which is that the PSC from canceled permits would go to the common pool. Option two would redistribute the PSC from the canceled permits to all remaining permits in the fishery, so it would be distributed evenly amongst common pool and sector vessels. The biological and economic impacts of this action are not substantial. The social impacts are expected to be positive because all the permits will benefit equally rather than just having the PSC be distributed to one portion of the fishery. There's currently 72,000 pounds of fish total on canceled permits, so we're talking about a very small number of permits that have been canceled and a small amount of fish. The stocks with the biggest poundage of this canceled PSC is that we have about 40,000 pounds of pollock and 10,000 pounds of Gulf of Maine cod. This could be a bigger issue if there was a buyback in the fishery and there was more PSC available from canceled permits, but at this point it's a relatively small amount. And the final measure in the Fishery Program Administration section of the document is submission of sector rosters. The no action maintains the September 1st submission deadline for new sectors, or sorry, for not new sectors, but for sector rosters for the following fishing year. And option two would revise the submission date to December 1st for sectors preceding the fishing year that the roster date is for. This year, the service changed the date several times. We got feedback that sector managers thought it would be helpful to have a date certain for the roster submission in order to assist planning of their operations for the following year. And for the impacts, we figure this will increase permit owner flexibility because they'll have slightly more time to decide what they want to do in the following fishing year. And that's it for section 4.2.
Okay, first motion in 4.2.1 of Framework 45 to only implement new sectors for which an operation plan was submitted by the deadline. And that one is a committee motion.
Discussion on the committee motion. Doug Grout.
So I guess the question that was brought up, does this, from the committee standpoint, does this mean that the three state sector operations plans that were submitted would not be usable at this particular point in time from the committee standpoint?
I don't want to speak for the whole committee, but I mean, the committee was made aware of that, and I would say that the committee considered that they would not be. But it was.
Terry?
Yeah, that's my recollection, which is why I voted against it at the committee.
Doug?
So I would not support the council motion on this. So I'm going to make a motion to amend this. If you give me 1 second. Put after deadline, put with the exception of the state operations plans, the three state operations plans that were submitted at the end of the deadline.
Is there a second? Seconded by Terry. Discussion on the motion to amend. Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just think it would be clearer if it said state permit bank operation plans. Isn't that what you're after?
Marcus.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I support the motion. You know, we're still trying to work with the service to understand how and if we can meet the sector requirements as state permit banks, and so we don't want to get closed out at this point. It may be that we can't meet those requirements, you know, in a timely fashion, but I don't want to see us get closed out now so that those that work and consultations can come to fruition if possible. Thank you.
So this would be, if this were to pass, this would be open-ended. There wouldn't be a deadline, right, as it's written. that's the intent. Doug?
Yeah, the point is we've submitted our operations plans. They still need to be refined because some of us have criteria in it that the service won't approve at this point, and we plan to make those changes. So they're in there now. They just got put in late because we're still trying to deal with this new concept that states would be opening owning permits.
Okay, so the plans have been submitted. It's just they weren't submitted by the deadline.
Right.
Okay. Anyone else on the council? Frank?
Yeah, just to make it clear, I think we should probably add the three states. I know they've already submitted them, but it should probably say Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, just so somebody else doesn't come up with a state plan for Delaware at the last minute. So, or Connecticut. Not to exclude Connecticut, but they haven't.
I'll accept that as a friendly if the seconder will.
Pat Kirkle?
Yeah, I support the motion. I think this is a bit of an unusual situation, and as Doug pointed out, all the plans have been submitted at this point, and so they've done all the work to get them ready and just missed the deadline by a fairly small amount of time, actually. So I support the motion.
Anyone else on the council? Go to the audience. Maggie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm speaking on behalf of the sustainable harvest sector. We did not submit an operations plan for the sector called Sustainable Harvest Sector 2. And we do have communication from NIMS, which indicates that the sector could still be approved in this framework, even though we had not submitted an operations plan. So while I am sympathetic to this amendment for the states, I think that the best way to deal with this would be to have this particular requirement become effective in 2012 for plans that are submitted for 2012 rather than for 2011, because we were under the assumption that this sector could be approved in this framework even though we had not submitted an operations plan by the deadline. I think the simplest way would just be to say that going forward, for new sectors that would be requested for 2012, that they would have to submit the operations plan by that deadline. Thank you.
Maggie, anyone else in the audience? Back to the council. Anything further from council members? You ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Favor, opposed, abstentions, one abstention. Frank?
Okay, next. To adopt 4.2.1, option 2, and framework 45. Whoop. Oh, yeah, that's right.
Sorry, that was a motion to amend. We'll need to vote again. Thought that went a little easy. Anything further on the motion, main motion as amended? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Fifteen. Opposed? Abstentions? One abstention. Now, Frank.
Thank you. To adopt 4.2.1, option 2, and framework 45, implementation of additional sectors. And I think, Ann, you have the list.
Yeah, I think it would be helpful here if we listed the sectors that are being approved just for absolute clarity with the document. So if you could write the state of Maine permit bank sector. Should be easier. State of Rhode Island. State of New Hampshire. State of Massachusetts. And sustainable harvest sector 3, according to the last motion.
Discussion? Needs a second. Do I have a second? Seconded by Rip. Discussion? Dr. Pierce?
Yeah, I support the motion for obvious reasons. We have a state-operated permit bank. I and I think other state-operated permit banks have expressed in the past concern that we're not sectors. We shouldn't be sectors. We have a unique feature. Nevertheless, the only option for us to pursue at this time is the sector option. And we're working with the National Marine Fisheries Service to, help us get through this process. We are developing an amendment, I believe, that would address the central concern of what indeed are state-operated permit banks, and that potentially would have us defined in a different way, so we would not be obliged to live with all the rules that sectors must live by, because obviously state-operated permit banks don't have active fishermen. It's an entirely different creature. So I just wanted to make that point for the record. Yes, indeed, we are a sector. The only option for us to pursue at this point in time. So we will support the motion.
Anyone else on the council? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Anything further? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous. Right.
Okay. Next, to adopt 4.2.2, option 2. Framework 45, which is hand gear and small vessel exemptions from dockside monitoring. And once that's up, you can see the rationale. This exempts these permit categories from the dockside monitoring requirements, and that would be hand gear A, hand gear B, and the small vessel exemption permits. Yes.
Do we have a second? Seconded by Terry Stockwell. Discussion. Doug Grout.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I support this. this gear type clearly lands a very small amount of cod, and the cost of implementing dockside monitoring for them, given the amount of, would not be cost effective for them if it came to the point, if and when we come to the point that they'd have to pay for this in the future. So,
anyone else in the council? Sally?
I know we're going to get there, but one of the main reasons that the committee gave on this, providing this exemption or recommending it, is because of equity issues, and those still remain in other portions of the fishery as well. So I know this is a relatively small decision in terms of the overall monitoring picture, but it feels a little bit out of order since we have bigger monitoring problems to address in this framework. So I just wanted to put that out there because, it addresses an equity issue, but it doesn't solve the bigger monitoring issue or other equity issues in terms of dockside monitoring requirements.
Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thanks. I don't disagree with Sally, but I view this as a standalone option. We have another issue here to talk about. Dockside monitoring altogether, I don't want to lose this in that part. So I'm in favor of this motion as it stands.
Anyone else on the council? Go to the audience. Mark?
Mark Stetner, Northeast Hook Fishermen Association. If you could turn to page 140 in your Framework 45 document, I think the data is pretty clear. Table 54, I'll give you a minute to get to it. Normal years, the hand gear A revenue was under $5,000 a year for groundfish. I'm hearing that just to even have a dockside monitoring company consider you, you got to cut them a check before they even show up at the pier. To weigh 150, 300 pounds of cod, this needs to be passed. This vote, if it doesn't go to option two to exempt us, there will be no more hand gear fishery because the cost will be more than anything we make in a normal year, not to even get into what happened to us this year. So this should be standalone. Time to detach the hand gear fishery and start treating it as its own type of fishery. It's very different. Thank you.
Yes, sir. And then you, sir.
Yes, good morning. My name is Paul Hoffman. I'm a New Hampshire hand gear fisherman also. I'm asking that you pass this option too. Because, as Mark stated, we're a very small part of the fishery, and it would put us out of business. Thank you.
Hillary Dombrowski, Hangare, Cape Ann Hook Fishermen's Association. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Council members. I think you all realize the situation we're in here. This is just one of many nails that are put in our coffin. We need to get this passed. Otherwise, there will be no diversity in your fishery program. The hand gear A's will cease to exist. We cannot handle the costs of this dockside monitoring. So we would appreciate your help in this avenue. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, my name is Roger Brisson, fishing vessel Blue Dagger, hand gear air permit. I support that option two because, like I was said, you know, we just can't afford to pay for this. Thanks.
You, anybody else? Back to the council. Anything further from the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Fifteen. Opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries. Frank?
Those were the easy ones. To adopt 4.2.3, option 2, option 3, and 4 in the framework 45. This is the removal of the dockside monitoring, removal of the requirement for industry to fund at-sea monitoring in 2012, and the continuation of the trip and hail. I need a second.
Is there a second? Seconded by Terry Stockwell. Discussion? Jimmy?
I'm opposed to the motion, option two, to remove dockside monitoring. And I'm going to offer a substitute motion for that section. And then option two will read that National Marine Fisheries Service provide as much funding as possible for up to 100% dockside monitoring through 2012 with a target of 100% if funds are available. And beginning in fishing year 2013, there be 100% dockside monitoring paid for by the dealers, period. That's the end of the motion. The rationale for this is that I'm convinced there will be a black market, or is a black market developing for unrecorded catch. And under a quota system, you have to be sure you are catching all the, recording all the landings. This is a very, people will do this, it's simple. You put 120 pounds in a box, for instance. By having the dealers pay for it, it is likely the cost will be spread out more evenly through the industry, therefore not disadvantaging the small boats or costing more for the bigger boats. I mean, this will even spread the cost to the end consumer. It's possible. Be much simpler to implement, much simpler to enforce. If it'll be simple, if somebody is unloading anywhere and there's not a dockside monitor, it's a violation. The dockside monitoring system will no longer have to go down in the fish hole. It'll be simple, just weigh the fish. We know from past experience that you need to monitor quota systems. So that's the rationale. Thank you.
Is there a second? On the motion to amend, is there a second? Seconded by Rip Cunningham. Discussion on the motion to amend. David Gaethel.
I oppose the motion. I oppose dockside monitoring in general. I think it's a waste of time and money. My sector manager, I can't see out in the audience. I don't know if he's here or not, but he wrote several letters that I can't find in our binders. They're academic-type letters. They're a dissection of the current program and the fact that the information is not being used and whatnot. If he's here, maybe he can come up and speak on his own because I don't have the letters. But this program, as it currently exists, really does nothing. It watches people weigh fish. Fishermen can do that. The joint enforcement agreement is far more effective at catching people who cheat. I've talked to people in four states. They all agree that the joint enforcement agreement is vastly superior to this current program. I think this program was a valuable exercise for 1 year just to see what it does or doesn't do. And now that we've seen it in operation for a while, I think, we've got to streamline the costs here somehow. This program is simply too expensive as it currently exists. The idea of having the dealers monitored, I think, is a good idea, but I'm not sure in the second meeting of a framework where we didn't notify people that it's an option. I mean, the dealers aren't here today. They probably would have rather strong feelings about, being charged for that, and they would probably like to comment on it. I just don't think this is the appropriate motion at this time. I'm going to oppose it and urge the rest of you to do so as well.
Mr. Libby.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. One of the big problems with dockside monitoring in rural locations, like where I come from, is the criteria for the people that you are going to hire to do the work. One of them is you can't have any connection, either work for or related to someone in the fishing industry, and I don't know where we've been unable to find anybody. We had somebody for one for about 2 weeks, and the other problem is there's not enough landings in a like Port Clyde or Stonington, for instance, where it's not a viable option for this neutral person. If you could change the guidelines for hiring, I think you would find more people. But until that happens, having 100% monitoring is going to be a real problem. Thank you.
Anyone else? Mike Leary?
Yeah, I'm opposed to this motion also. The way that dockside monitoring now, they don't even go out of the building where I take out. They don't get on the boat. They don't look at the fish holds. I mean, you could have 15 totes on deck and they wouldn't even notice. So the last trip I made, I had a at-sea monitor, I had a dockside monitor, and I had a JAE agent when I get in. And I had a dealer report. And I don't know where all those numbers are going, but I could guarantee you nobody's looking at all four of those. So I'm opposed to this motion.
How'd you check out? Was everything all right? Pat Kirkle.
I have just a question for clarification at this point. So this means that if there is no federal funding in 2012, there's no dockside monitoring in 2012, but so fund up to what we can, and then it reverts. Okay, thanks.
Anyone else from the council? Mark Gibson.
Yes, I oppose the motion. I think Dave Gaethel said it exactly correctly. It's a big waste of time and money. I never understood from the beginning what this program was going to add that we don't already have in terms of accounting for the catch. So I oppose it. Thank you.
Sally.
This is a tough one, and since the committee meeting, I know a lot of people have been trying to figure out how to deal with both ATSI and dockside monitoring to make the whole of the system function better. I do think that 100% dockside monitoring would get at some of the problems with the current system as far as the actual utility of the numbers. My understanding from the committee meeting, and I'd look to the service to clarify this, is that the protocols for dockside monitors is going to change as far as actually going on board, making sure that they're documenting all the fish that's been brought back to the dock, even if it hasn't yet come off of the boat. So that's part of this. I think aside from what we might do here today, there might be some value in going back to the industry, which convened before the completion of Amendment 16, to work out the kind of an initial pass at how to monitor the fishery, both at sea and dockside. So regardless of how this motion and the underlying motion goes, I hope that that's something that can happen, because regardless of, so if this passes or if it doesn't, we're still unresolved as far as having a comprehensive monitoring system that people have faith in and that's collecting information that's actually going to be used in management. So I'm still on the fence on this motion, but hope we can take this discussion further than probably what the council will be able to today.
Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to add to what Sally was saying, I think that at the future discussion may also have to look to perhaps dividing up the industry on size by size of vessel in terms of some of these costs, since for the smaller vessels they are substantially disproportionate to their landing. So that's in future considerations, we may have to look in that direction as well.
Anyone else on the council? Dr. Pierce.
And considering this is the final action on the framework, is the last part of this motion appropriate, where it says the funds are available, but beginning in fishing year 2013, there'd be 100% dockside monitoring paid for by the dealers. Is that within the bounds of this framework?
You bring up a good point, Dr. Pierce. I'm going to call for a break right here and have some discussions. We'll take a 15-minute break, and then I'll go to Karen, if you could put the motion on the board when you have a chance. Thank you. As I said before the break, I was going to go to the audience, so I'm looking for comments from the audience on the motion on the board. Anyone in the audience? Steve?
Hi, Steve Welch, commercial fisherman from Scituate, Mass. I'm opposed to this motion just for the fact that generally when the cost is handed on to a dealer, it comes out of the cod end of the boat. That's one reason I understand where Jimmy's going with this. I mean, ultimately, it'd be nice to monitor every pound of fish that's landed. Eventually, we'll have more fish to land ourselves. I see the problem. I don't want to get off track here, but I see the problem. A lot of it has to do with just people with recreational fishing that go and sell to the restaurants around town in Scituate, in the South Shore. That happens quite a bit. That's not monitored. I see that being a problem. But the fact that having to pay for a dockside monitor where the information's not really being used for us right now is tough, because on the South Shore and the small boats, we run our business on such small margins that the cost of a monitor at the end of the year ultimately just comes out of my bottom line, and the bottom line right now is very low. It was so low for me this year that I had to lease my fish, because it was going to be, because of sectors and the way it's being implemented, it's cheaper for me to stay tied to the dock than to go out and lease fish, pay for the sector fee, and the dockside monitoring costs, et cetera, even though we're not paying for that this year. But for those couple of reasons, I'm opposed to this.
Steve. Mr. Libby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gary Libby from Port Clyde, Maine. I'm a commercial ground fisherman. I'm opposed to the motion because of the way it's operated throughout this year. We've had a lot of problems getting people down on the dock in the rural areas, as some of the members have, council members have said, and I agree with a lot about this is a fairly costly program the way it exists right now, and to put a bunch of more money into it without setting the program up better, if we could get the people trained and on the dock, and they need to come on the vessel because they haven't been able to do that. If they can get all that stuff in place, it probably could work, but for right now, I oppose the motion. I think we should pretty much wait a year and maybe get the system up and running right before you go and implement 100%, because I don't think it's ready for prime time right now. I think we should eliminate it maybe for next year, and then possibly, if it can be worked out with costs in one thing and another, that it could work. But the last point I want to make is the end of the motion where you said dealers are going to pay for it. Everybody knows that any cost that goes out to dealers goes out to fishermen, because they just pass cost along. It works in every program, and it always will. So just tell the industry they're going to pay for it, and instead of dealing with the dealer part, because they will in the end. Thank you.
Richie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rich Canastro, Whalen City Auction, Boston Auction. I'm in favor of the motion. I'm in favor of 100% or zero. 20% dockside monitoring is going to give us nothing. Nothing whatsoever. Your miles will just eliminate it to no dockside monitoring or 100%. Because that 20% is not going to help us out in the figures. And as far as costs go and the industry paying for it, I'll guarantee you that I can strike a better deal with dockside monitoring, with the monitoring services, than what a sector can do, only because of the pure volume from 18 to 20 million pounds at one facility. I can get that cost down. The other issue is, as far as product being left over on vessels, you know, the dockside monitors do not go on the vessels. So, but that's the chance that the vessel takes. If they want to leave 15 totes on their boat, and that's when the Office of Law Enforcement comes in. And the other thing it eliminates is unreported catch. If you go to 100%, there won't be any more unreported catch. So I'm in favor for the for 100% or zero. The 20%, you're only kidding yourself. It doesn't give us anything. Thanks.
Andy.
Hi, Andy Baylor. I'm a dealer. I will agree with half of that motion. Obviously, when you speak with the dockside monitors, their feeling themselves is it's either 100% or it's nothing. And 100% is the only way to do this. So what was just said by Richie, it's either zero or 100%. At our facility in Chatham, they're observing everything when they're there. It functions quite well. The dysfunction is they spend 70% of their observer time handling observed trips of skates and dogs. If you were to do this, you do it with the multi-species on the groundfish alone, get 100%. That might also reduce some of the costs. I would just like to read a letter from the Gloucester Fish Exchange, Larry. He wasn't able to be here, so he wanted me to read this for you. Members of the council, the Gloucester Fish Exchange would like to strongly express our support for 100% dockside monitoring of all vessel landings. Our experience to date has been proved very positive. The dockside monitors have worked professionally and courteously to benefit the transparency of our business and the future of the fishing industry. We believe that the continuation of dockside monitoring and the addition of 100% coverage are necessary for our overall industry and the cooperation between regulators, fishermen, and unloading facilities. We have found that dockside monitoring has been only beneficial. The outcome to this point has produced some of the following results. It's maintaining accurate account of species and weights being landed. Allows for proper calculation of allocated allowable catches. And I repeat, allocated allowable catches, which will change without 100% observer coverage. Helps to coordinate cooperation between regulators, enforcement, and the fishing industry. Keeps all vessels and facilities open and honest. One point of concern we'd like to express is the burden of the cost of the dockside monitor to the vessel. Presently, the cost is totally the responsibility of the vessel. We feel that some changes need to be made. It is unfair to ask the vessel to take all the burden. Both state, federal funding, as well as dockside facilities should all be contributing to the cost, since it will benefit all. We strongly urge the council to support the continuation of the dockside monitoring. Sincerely, Larry Chula, President, Gloucester Fish Exchange. Thank you.
Anyone else? Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm Joe Jerick, and I'm a fisherman. And there's no doubt that you need to keep accurate and honest records of what's getting landed, but something needs to be done about the way it's set up right now, because it just seems so redundant to have the dockside monitoring paperwork going to the sector manager and that not really being used, because the actual tally that's getting taken off your quota is from the dealer landing slip. So I think that if you could, you know, it's like anything in life, you know, the person that you work for is the person that you're loyal to. So if what we're really talking about is having an accurate record of what's coming off of your quota getting reported to the fishery service, it seems like the dockside monitoring people should be working for the government so that they can make them the kind of person that they want them to be, have them carry a gun so they can come down on your boat. And, you know, that's really who they're working for. And that's why I think that if the, you know, that's who should be paying them too, the government, not the fishermen. Because I know that it's all based on, you know, us trying to make some money. But when it comes to getting that accurate, honest data, and, you know, you can't trust people, you got to have some government agency come in and make sure it's accurate and honest. And that's why it seemed like, you know, the joint enforcement thing where the fish caught, you know, the environmental police would come down and do it. It seemed like a more official, they had that, you know, the aura of they're in charge of the scene. And the way it is now, it just seems like a guy standing there and it's not, you know, it's a waste of, like Dave said, I think it's redundant and a waste of money right now. The way it is, I mean, I'm not saying we don't need it, but I guess I'm opposed to having the industry pay for it.
Thank you. Anyone else? Back to the council. I think we're going to need to strike that line in the motion that references dealers paying in 2013. This is our final. This is the final meeting where we hope to take action, and there's been no prior notice to the dealers or to the public, and so. Short of calling it out of order, I'll ask the maker and the seconder if they'll strike that part of it. Jimmy.
Yes, thank you, John. I would like to perfect the motion a little bit, and it will strike that last sentence. And after available, I want to add prioritizing vessels that do not have an at-sea observer. Period.
Okay, the seconder agrees. Is there any objection? Seeing none. Jimmy?
Yeah, and I mean, on the sidebar, we were talking about that we could deal with this in one of the next framework, so I'm going to take that as we will be able to do that and insert it in our priorities for 2013. Thank you.
Pat Kirkle.
Yeah, just a couple of pieces of information for the council. As was mentioned earlier, we are all learning under this process, and so we're looking at ways to improve the dockside monitoring program. And certainly one of the things that everyone has highlighted and that we feel strongly about at this point is making sure that we do require the dockside monitors to observe all of the offloading. So that would require them to go on the boat and make sure that everything has been offloaded. And I think that'll certainly make the program more effective. The other thing I would mention is that, yes, it has been difficult in remote areas to find people to do the dockside monitoring. One of the issues there is that it's sort of an intermittent type position. And so certainly if this was 100% and it was full time, that might become less of an issue. And I do think that the sectors rely on this information. So.
Anyone else from the council? Sally McGee.
Thanks. I think the changes to the motion improve it substantially. Having vessels prioritized that don't have an at-sea observer, while it doesn't give us 100% coverage, but it comes pretty close to it, because every vessel will have there will be an eye on every vessel, whether it's at-sea coverage or dockside. So presumably that is going to improve the effectiveness of the dockside system, which everyone had recognized that at 20%, it wasn't coming anywhere near close to closing that gap between the 35% plus that are observed at sea with the remainder of vessels that don't have any monitoring that's done on them. And Pat, thank you for your clarification on the protocols that are going to be improved in terms of how the vessels are monitored dockside. I think with that, we're moving in the right direction, not quite there, but I'm certainly going to vote in support of this motion. Thank you.
Mr. Libby.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify, I'm not necessarily opposed to this, but just to respond again to what Pat just said, that maybe if we have 100%, then it would be more of a full-time job. We're talking about some of these ports where there may be 25 landing events all summer, so it's not really a monetary concern, again, about finding monitors. It's the criteria. There's plenty of people who may be retired or close to it who would love to have a part-time job and come down and weigh fish, but they're already related to somebody or have ties to the fishing industry and are not able to. That's the biggest problem that we're seeing, is the criteria for employment for this position. I think if that was relaxed somewhat, you'd have no problem filling the positions and streamlining the whole process for these remote ports. Thank you.
Doug Rout.
Yeah, a couple questions for Pat. One of the issues that was brought up with sectors 11 and 12 was having some vessels that monkfish down in New Jersey, Virginia area, where there's very little groundfish catch. And is there any intent on the part of the National Fishery Service to relax that requirement, because that's one of the things that is significantly increasing the per landing cost of monitoring, dockside monitoring? And after I get an answer to that question, I have a follow-up.
Yeah, we look pretty closely at that issue and talked a lot about whether or not there should be some sort of southern boundary, eastern boundary, for the requirement for dockside monitoring, and ended up concluding, and I think we've talked with both the council and the committee about it at this point, but that that would really be up to the council to set that kind of a boundary.
My follow-up is, as of right now, is there any funding at all from National Marine Fisheries Service for dockside monitoring in 2012?
We don't have our budget yet, so I don't know. the funding that we had, we were able to pay forward into 2011, if. You know, that funding will go as long as it'll, you know, as long as that funding is available, it'll go into 2011 and then into 2012. Whether or not we're going to be able to augment that or not will depend on our budget.
And finally, this is a question for the maker of the motion. The way I read this, and I want to make sure it's correct, that we're still removing the industry responsibility for dockside monitoring 2012, and that all we're going to do is whatever funds are available from National Marine Fisheries Service to conduct dockside monitoring at whatever level up to 100% would be the only way that this would be funded at this point in time.
That's correct.
Dave Gaethel.
I continue to oppose the motion. If you want to put the small boats out of business, I can't think of a faster way to do it than to require them to pay for this. I agree it works in the major ports at major unloading facilities because the dockside monitor basically hangs around there all day. It does not work in the outlying ports. In New Hampshire, for example, in Rye, New Hampshire, we have to pay for a monitor to ride to Rye and then follow the truck back to the Yankee Co-op through Hampton Beach. That can easily take 3 hours in the summer. And basically, like somebody said, I mean, the boat may unload 3,000 pounds of dogfish, a bunch of skates, and 300 pounds of groundfish. And the whole thing's got to be observed. So there's this huge time period. And as near as I can tell, the funding, all the dockside monitoring companies now are all charging somewhere around $70 to $80 an hour for dockside monitoring. And they all have different requirements, you know, in terms of minimum amount of time and things like that. But the fact is there's only four of them that are government approved. And basically they're a government approved monopoly. And so there's no incentive at all to reduce costs one bit, as Richie said. I'm sure if you could hire some retired guy to come down and watch these fish get weighed, you wouldn't have to pay this kind of money to do it. But the fact is that there's only four companies that are approved. And it's funny how all their prices have converged to be pretty much the same. So, again, I don't see a value to the product. I think the cost is excessive. I think Jimmy's idea of having the choke point be the dealer is probably the right way to go, but that requires work in the future. And if you approve 100% dockside monitoring for the next 2 years, you're going to have a lot less dealers to have to put monitors at, because there's going to be a heck of a lot less boats, because a guy who catches 300 pounds of cod can't afford to pay $70 or $80 an hour for 3 hours to have that fish get some guy watch it get weighed at the fish co-op. You just can't do it. There's only funding available next year for 20% coverage. So where's the other 80% going to come from? It's coming out of somebody's wallet. And if you come in with 50,000 pounds and it takes you 4 hours to unload it, that $300 may not be that much compared to your gross stock. But if it's 300 pounds and it costs you that same amount of money, 4 hours, to get that event monitored, it's more than the value of the fish. So you better think long and hard before you vote for this, because if you vote for it, you're basically saying if you're big, it isn't going to cost you that much, and if you're little, you may as well just jump out the window.
I think this says that there is no industry-funded component, right? Okay. Anyone else on the council? Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I still have significant concerns about the cost of industries, rural communities, and the small boats, but the perfections in this motion are going to buy us a time over the next couple of years to develop in a future action measures to address that, particularly those that were mentioned by Glenn. And I certainly hope and expect that we can perfect the monitoring program so it's user-friendly and cost-effective, and This will, through 2012, will be a great help to the industry.
Anyone else on the council? Rick?
John, just to follow up on Doug Grouse's comments about this being expanded into states like New Jersey and Virginia, was there any option for a boundary, for a geographic boundary, and what are the implications, for example, if one were established, is there a significant loss of data to the system? I wasn't privy to that committee discussion, so I wonder if there was any option for that.
I'll turn to the committee chair.
We did not discuss a boundary. I'll come up with a solution anyway.
I think based on that, the next action we would take in groundfish could take up the consideration of a southern boundary. Jim Fair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've never made any secret that I don't like port side sampling. I don't think it's practical. I don't think it's necessary. But we just heard on Tuesday that we're hiring a fairly good number of new uniformed officers, and I would much rather have the service pay those officers to do spot checks on the dealers, and including their record keeping, and I think that would be much more effective than what we're trying to do now.
Doug Grout.
Just to follow up, because of some of the discussion at this council, right now the industry is not paying for dockside monitoring. This coming fishing year, they're not paying for dockside monitoring. If this motion passes, the industry will not be paying for dockside monitoring in 2012. We're certain about that right now. Okay, thank you.
Jimmy?
Yeah, I just want to point out, it hasn't been mentioned, that I mean, one of the goals of this is to narrow uncertainty. If we can narrow uncertainty, we can put more fish on the table, and therefore the industry can get a return.
Mark Alexander.
Thank you. I believe that with the prospect of, or the possibility of, less than 100% observer coverage, that makes it all the more necessary that the dockside monitoring that does get performed is done by law enforcement. I think that the threat of arrest and that they carry with them tends to compensate for the fact that you don't have 100% coverage. I believe that, with pre-landing notification, you couple that with, random JEA inspections, focusing on, the unobserved trips, I believe that would just be more effective than an attempt at, dockside monitoring that may not reach 100%.
Anyone else on the council? Okay, the motion did change. I'll go back to the audience. Maggie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had a question about to Pat about her comments about potentially changing the dockside monitoring protocol to require the monitors to go aboard the vessel and into the fish hold. And my question is that something that the agency feels they can unilaterally do, or do they need a recommendation, action from the council in order to implement that requirement?
It's something we can change. It's one of the standards, but it would be through notice and comment rulemaking.
Well, I'll just take the opportunity to say that's a problem for people to be climbing up and down ladders in fish holes. It's a huge liability issue for vessel owners. My understanding is that the dockside monitors currently ask the captain if all the fish is offloaded, and I'm not sure that he has to sign something to that effect, but that could be that my concern about liability could be addressed if the captain or the representative of the vessel were required to, to say that everything's been offloaded, and then if that it turns out that it isn't, then that person can be charged with a penalty for lying. If this motion does pass, to the other issue of the area requirements for this, we had requested in our operations plan for this year an exemption for monitoring west of 7230, and that was not approved because the agency said that the council would have to weigh in on that. So if this motion does pass, I would hope that you would follow up with the motion that restricts that does not impose a monitoring requirement in an area where there is no ground fish. It does present an expense that is not necessary and could potentially then increase the level of coverage that's in the area where people are catching and offloading ground fish. Thank you.
Mr. Libby?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Still opposed to it because I don't think it's ready. But the last thing that you guys changed up about 100%, unless you get an at-sea observer. If you had the observer on the boat, then you don't get the dockside monitoring, which I think is a good idea because you've already been monitored once. But we're in the process now of doing programs with cameras on boats. So if boats, this is a question, I guess, if boats carried a camera and they would be at 100% at sea with the camera, does that mean they're 100% exempt from dockside?
We don't know. We don't allow the use of cameras right now.
Oh, okay.
So that'll be until, part of the debate.
Until a pilot program is complete and cameras are accepted tool, then that would you wouldn't be exempt unless you was carrying an observer physically.
That's my understanding right now. Sure.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience? Back to the council. Anything further from the council? Anything further from the council? You ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. I count 10. Opposed. 6 in opposition. Motion to amend carries 10-6. Now we're on the main motion as amended. Anything further, Dr. Pierce?
Yeah, I'm struggling with option 3, remove the requirement for industry funding of at-sea monitoring in fishing year 2012. I say I'm struggling because when I go to the document itself, page 245, and I look at the environmental consequences analysis of the impacts, I see very compelling arguments for our not going with that decision to remove the requirement for 2012. We're not getting rid of it entirely. We are just getting rid of it for 2012. It still would be in place for 2013 and on. I see some confusion. All right. Well, anyways, so it's removal of the requirement for industry funding. The description of this particular option at first makes it seem that if we do indeed remove that requirement, then there will be some dramatic consequences for us specific to ACLs, increasing uncertainty, not being able to get a good handle on amount of discards. So I read that paragraph and I said, well, I don't think it makes sense to remove the requirement for industry funding for fishing year 2012. But then again, I go to the next paragraph and it makes a compelling argument to indeed hold off and to wait until 2013, I assume with the hope that sectors in particular will become more profitable, more economically viable. They will have worked through a couple of years of difficulty. They will be running better, hence the economic burden on them would not be as great. So that's why I said, and I'm saying that I'm a bit uncertain as to which way to go. I am likely, however, and I will vote to postpone it until 2013. And as I will support the motion, but I support it with reservations. The reservations are the ones I've just referenced that are clearly stated in that part of the impact analysis. This is not an action to be taken by us lightly because it will have some consequences that could be quite adverse for us in terms of our being able to track mortality the way we need to, and in order for us to reduce uncertainty the way we need to. So with that said, I'll still support the motion with reservations.
Pat?
Yeah. So on that option 3, I think, as you pointed out, Mr. Chairman, I've been pretty clear about the agency's position on the council putting forward monitoring requirements without funding to pay for them. So I just want to make sure the council understands that so this all this delays is the industry's requirement to pay for them. It does not delay the ATSI monitoring requirements in 2012, and so, in fact, then there is no funding mechanism to pay for them in 2012. If what you're really trying to do is say something similar to what was just put forward on the dockside monitoring, and that's, you know, if there is federal funding, the federal funding should be used in 2012, then industry pays in 2013. Then that's not what it says. So I just want to make sure the council is very clear on this, and, you know, as it is, I don't think it's approvable. So you may want to think about some options to it that put that contingency in, that if there is some sort of federal funding, then that would be used in 2012.
So just so I'm clear on this, if this motion passes and we're removing the requirement for industry-funded ATSI monitoring, and perchance the service comes up in their budget for 2012 for ATSI monitoring, would this, if you disapprove this particular option, would it preclude you from paying for?
No, it would not.
Anyone else on the council? We're on the main motion as amended. Anything further? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Fourteen. Opposed? Two. Motion carries as amended. 14-2. Doug Grout.
On this topic, I would like to make a motion not to require dockside monitoring west of the 7230 line.
Is there a second? Seconded by Rodney. Pat?
I think a simpler way, given that this wasn't part of the framework, might be to just say that the council supports an exemption to sectors for dockside monitoring west of 7230.
I'm willing to amend my motion, if the seconder agrees to it, to address that.
Seconder agrees. Discussion? Dr. Pierce.
I need a chart. Can't recall. Where is 7230?
Shinnecock. David Gith.
Well, that was going to be my question. I'm not sure, but I think New Hampshire might be west of 7230. I can't remember.
Doug, is New Hampshire west of 7230?
It's east. It's east.
I'm sorry. We're 7030, I think, not 72.
But,
it's Connecticut. I just want to point out, though, somebody better check the line here and see what it is exactly they're exempting.
And?
I think it would be helpful to be clear whether this applies to fish caught west of that line or landed west of that line, and also whether it applies to the common pool when they have dockside monitoring requirements starting in 2012.
Some suggestions from staff on clarifying the motion. What's the intent? Did you hear Ann's questions, Doug?
Sorry.
Ann, could you repeat?
I was looking up where 7030 line was.
Can you repeat that, Ann?
The question was whether this would apply to where fish were caught or where they were landed, and also whether it would apply to the common pool when they have dockside monitoring requirements starting in 2012.
For clarification, I would say whether they're landed, since we're talking about dockside monitoring. And I think this would also apply to the common pool.
I feel like we're going into a gray zone here. I'm a little unclear as to what's happening on this issue.
I'm just trying to address a concern that was brought up by the sectors 11 and 12. I asked a question of the service. They said it would require some kind of action by the council. So I'm trying to address something that was causing the cost of dockside monitoring to our federal taxpayers to be probably unreasonably high for the amount of information that you're getting out of it. That's my justification behind it. I understand the difficulty of this being as being included as we are about ready to approve the final framework. This probably would have been an issue that would have been better addressed at the Groundfish Committee level. However, it wasn't, and so I'm trying to address it now at the council level.
And I think that my concern was the timing more than the issue. Was there correspondence available to the committee on this issue?
I don't recall this coming up at all.
Was there correspondence in your packet that you just didn't get to, or?
I think that one of the regional office employees did bring it up at one point during a committee meeting and say that this was something that the office was going to ask for. But because of the option in the document to remove dockside monitoring and the committee vote to support that, that was something that we didn't end up discussing at length.
That's helpful background. Pat?
I think maybe what we need to do is take a step back here, because you can't include the common pool because this is the operations plan, there's exemptions in the operations plans. So what the council can do is, when we publish the operations plans, comment at that point on the requested exemptions from the industry. So I think that's a better way to do it.
I could tell you, I would feel more comfortable approaching that issue in that way, as opposed to putting a motion into the framework on the final meeting on an issue that, you know, we haven't really debated. Doug.
So then the intent of this would be if this would be taken up as potentially a motion at one of the subsequent council meetings.
Right. Yeah, I think what Pat's saying is that when the request for comments, when they publish the ops plans for the sectors, there's an opportunity for the council to comment on those operations plans as a body. And she's suggesting that would be the perhaps a better place for the council to weigh in on that issue, assuming those sectors request those exemptions. Gene wants to get involved.
Just a follow-up, just real quick. And if we did that, we made those comments in, say, the January meeting or April meeting, would that be a sufficient time for the service to take action to have it in place by the beginning of the fishing year?
We may not actually see the ops plan and have an opportunity to comment on them until the April meeting, when we that might be the next time we assemble as a body. Gene?
Well, the allowance for sectors to ask for this exemption would have to be in place. Because now I think they can't ask for this exemption, right? Because it's a reporting monitoring requirement. And so this gives the leeway for sectors to ask for the exemption. I guess I'm just asking for clarification with the regional office, is that if that's the way they see it. Right now, you can't. If this is considered a reporting requirement, then sectors can't ask for an exemption. for it. So this would create, this would allow sectors to ask for that exemption, but it would have to be in place, implemented, before they could be granted that exemption. And they could ask for it, I guess, and as long as it's, the framework is commensurate, or the implementation of the framework is commensurate with the operations plan going into place, we could do it.
Well, let me ask this question. What reporting requirements are based on dockside monitoring currently? Is there a requirement to report out dockside monitoring to the,
well,
to the agency?
That's what I was asking the regional office to clarify, whether they think this is a reporting requirement that can't be exempted.
Pat?
Yes, Doug just got a frantic email from the audience to say that this is, in fact, a reporting, listed as a reporting requirement in the regulations. It's the trip start, trip end, as well as the information that's collected. So I think that, yeah, what the council would need to do is, in a framework action, exempt this from the reporting requirement, the restriction on being able to ask for exemptions from reporting requirements. So it is getting a lot more complicated, Mr. Chairman. Sorry.
I'd like to hear from some other council members. I just, maybe you can guide me into feeling more comfortable about this. I just feel it's our last meeting, and we haven't had any formal discussion prior to this meeting about this issue. So I turn to you to help guide me through how, you know, if you think I'm feeling, if I'm, my feelings are right on this, then I'd appreciate hearing that otherwise. Dr. Pierce?
Well, I'm uncomfortable with it because I really don't understand it. Consequences of it. There's nothing in the document itself that addresses the issue, so it's brand new, final action on the framework. I think it potentially exempts most of Connecticut. I know groundfish isn't big in Connecticut, but nevertheless it exempts Connecticut. But maybe it'll lead in a shift of effort from Rhode Island to Connecticut ports in order to avoid the reporting. I say that facetiously, of course, but I'm just uncomfortable with it.
Dave Gale.
Yeah, the issue is monkfish trips, skate trips, dogfish trips that have landed in New Jersey in the winter. And the monkfish trips have been, I guess, declared gear capable of catching groundfish, even if they're fishing off Virginia, so they got to have a monitor. What this motion says, as David Pierce rightly pointed out, is anybody with the capability of steaming west of 7230, whether it's a groundfish trip or anything else, can unload without a dockside monitor. And I don't think that's what we want. What we want is to exempt directed monkfish, dogfish, and skate trips in ports like Point Pleasant down to Virginia, which don't catch any groundfish. I mean, they had dockside monitoring last year. I don't think they catch any at all from dockside monitoring requirements, because the dockside monitors have to redeploy from New England to the Mid-Atlantic. And again, as I referenced the cost a little earlier, that costs a great deal of money because you've got to pay for that redeployment. And, I realize the taxpayer is paying for dockside monitors at the moment, but we're all taxpayers here. It's still your money that's disappearing down this black hole. And, I'm really upset with this whole dockside monitoring program, so maybe it's not fair of me to speak on it. But I think that Doug's got the right idea, but I don't think this is the right motion, because I don't think he actually addresses the real issue, which is these monkfish trips being required to have a monitor.
Anyone else? Mark?
Just to clarify, although a good part of Connecticut is west of 7230, the principal ports where groundfish are landed are east of 7230.
Roddy?
Yeah, I was going to say the initial same thing Doug said, and David is correct. We should specify what we want, monkfish, dogfish, and skate. because there is no ground fish caught west of 7230. That's Shinnecock Inlet.
Anyone else in the council? Doug?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, clearly this has become a much more complicated issue than I anticipated, and so I feel that this is something that should be included in one of the next frameworks, an issue to be addressed. Whether the federal government's paying for it or whether the industry is, we need to get away from this. So I'm willing to withdraw my motion if the seconder agrees to it, and with the intent that I'd like us to include this in one of the next frameworks.
Anyone else in the council? Rodney?
Yeah, I just have a question. So if we withdraw this, anybody that lands a trip down in New Jersey of monkfish is still going to be required to have a dockside monitor.
Yep.
Okay.
Mike?
Yeah, I think when you fish down there, you're on a monkfish only day.
Right.
So all we have to say is, and this is just, we're just supporting an exemption in the sector's operations plan. That's all we're doing. So the sectors actually have to ask for it. And the council's just saying here now, yeah, we would support that. And that's all we can do is leave it at that. You know, a monkfish day in the southern area, you know, landing west of 7230.
Terry.
My recollection is that we did have some conversation in the Groundfish Committee about this, but it was never formalized into a motion. It came up, as a matter of fact, a couple times. And I agree with the concept of it. I also agree with that this language doesn't do it, although the intent is there. So I don't know how you want to work it, Mr. Chair. I hate to see it withdrawn, but I don't have perfection for it right now.
Go to the audience, Maggie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Doug, for bringing this issue up. I think what Pat was trying to say was right now they're not allowing vessels to ask for exemptions from any of the dockside monitoring requirements based on a geographical area because the amendment says they consider it a reporting requirement, and the amendment says you can't ask for an exemption from a reporting requirement. So I think to simplify it, if you just, you know, expressed a support for sectors making the case to the agency in their operations plan and the environmental assessment that there is a geographical area where they fish, not where they land, where they fish, where there is no groundfish catch because of the gear that they are using. And then the sectors can make that request. They each sector, I mean, I think ultimately that 7230 will be the line where they say that they would fish where there is no groundfish catch. But all you really need to do is give the agency authority to consider those kinds of requests. And I don't think you need to get into the exact details of it, but just to recognize that that's a legitimate request and that the agency should evaluate it based on the information that's provided by the within the request for the exemption.
Anyone else in the audience? Tom Neese.
I kind of look to the regional office reps, but, you know, Amendment 16 is pretty clear that these are called monitoring requirements, not reporting requirements. And the amendment makes it clear that as these programs are developed, there's supposed to be considerable discussion and considerable development of the program, and it puts the responsibility on the sector to detail the monitoring program. And it's unclear to me why the assumption is that the sector can't develop a monitoring program that perhaps includes some landing area like this, and then have NMFS approve it, and you say, you know, they're actually not acting for an exemption from the amendment. They're complying with the amendment. The amendment says design a monitoring program that's adequate and that NMFS determines is adequate. And, you know, if that program says, you know, we're not however it's worded, this exemption applies and NMSA approves it, it seems like it meets the requirement there. I guess I'm a little baffled how that language in the amendment got twisted into saying that there is absolutely a requirement that you have all landings monitored everywhere and you can't ask for an exemption from that because that's a reporting requirement.
It's a little late to have this argument. The council deemed the regulations to be consistent. It's in the regulations. That's where we are.
I think we could probably pass a motion today that asks or that removes dockside monitoring from the list of reporting requirements, thereby creating an avenue for sectors to seek exemptions on a sector-by-sector basis and make the case in their operations plan for just this type of a situation without getting into the specifics of what the line is and what the activities are that we're seeking to exempt. Simply removing the dockside monitoring from a list of reporting requirements in the regulation. And then it's between the sectors and the agency with an opportunity for the councils to review, the council to review each operations plan, each requested exemption, and comment. So I think that would be a better motion than the motion we have on the board right now. Doug?
Would it be best if I made that motion and we could get comments from the service and legal counsel as to that's an appropriate way?
Maybe we can just ask the service and our legal counsel before we even make the motion.
Bottom line is, could we do that? Could we make a motion to remove dockside monitoring from a list of reporting requirements for sectors?
Yes, and you know, I think it probably does make the most sense to do it this way. The only caveat, again, is that measure, as part of the framework, has to be implemented in time to make it operational for an operations plan. Now, the sectors can ask for it before it's approved, and we just have to time the actual operation of that exemption or the effectiveness of that exemption with the implementation of the framework.
Can I make a motion to substitute my own motion?
I think you can.
So I move to substitute removing dockside monitoring from a list of reporting requirements for sectors.
Is there a second? Seconded by Terry Stockwell. Discussion? Anything further? Dave Gatham.
Just a question. Does that mean that, as an example, if could a sector could a sector ask to be removed from the dockside monitoring requirements anywhere, and implement its own plan that would allow for that could be approved, as an example, or is this just for monkfish?
I think if this passes, the sector can make a case, whatever case it wants to make, for an exemption.
Okay. I just wanted to be sure that everybody knows what they're voting on. Thank you.
Anything further, Sally?
So how does this relate then to the motion that just passed previously as far as not the require? We didn't pass a requirement for dockside monitoring for sectors to explain it in their operations plan, but there is a requirement for dockside monitoring. So how is this consistent? I think I'm missing something. Can you explain that? So it's they just have to explain their exemption?
Right. Right now, sectors are subject to all requirements in the plan unless they're exempted through their operations plan. And this would give sectors the option of asking for one additional exemption to all the others that they're asking for from the otherwise required dockside monitoring requirement.
If I could then, just one more example aside from the one that that Doug raised. On the previous motion, there was a discussion about electronic monitoring, at sea monitoring, potentially being something that would be universally applied to a sector, and then in that case, maybe they wouldn't, they could apply for an exemption from dockside monitoring, which might be something that would be appealing for some of the more remote ports. Is that an example of where this might, this could apply? Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. You ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Fifteen. Opposed? One. Abstentions? Motion carries 15-1. That was the motion. To vote one more time because that was a motion to substitute. Ready for the question? All those in favor? 15. Opposed? One. Any abstentions? Motion carries as substituted 15-1. Frank?
Okay. To adopt 4.2.4, option number 2, distribution of PSC from canceled permits. And 4.2.5, option 2, and framework 45, which would make December 1st the submission of sector rosters. And I need a second.
Seconded by Rip Cunningham. Discussion. Sally McGee.
Yeah, could I know Ann mentioned how much this amounts to for the canceled permits, but can we just hear what the poundage is estimated to be at this point?
It's pretty low. The total for 3 years, 2008 through 2010, was only a little over 72,000 pounds. And most of it was pollock.
Dr. Pierce?
Yeah, still unclear to me how it would be reallocated. Redistributed the PSC to remaining permits. So how would that be done?
Ann?
Basically what it does is for the percentage of the PSC that's been canceled, that gets redistributed amongst the remaining permits to the extent to which they have their percentage. So it, the ACE that that's associated with gets distributed according to the percentage of the remaining permit holders, and those get adjusted back to one. Is that clear?
Yeah, it seems to me that it makes more sense just to put it into the common pool. I mean, PSC is, the permit is no longer active. I just don't see the logic of putting it into sectors. It's a small amount of fish, I realize that, but at the same time, they're no longer in a sector. So if they're not in the sector, why should sectors benefit from that amount that's now available for redistribution? It should go into the common pool, I would think. Plus, if we do adopt this motion, does it in some way conflict with the existing language of the amendment regarding how we allocate fish between fishermen?
Well, I think whether you're in a sector or in the common pool, there's a PSC calculation. So the quota available to the common pool is based upon those vessels. I don't want to use the word. I guess it's ACE, right? So that's how you arrive at the quotas stock by stock for the common pool.
Right, it's PSC, but if someone with that PSC decides not to get into a sector, then it's in the common pool. All of that poundage or tonnage goes into the common pool. So I'm having trouble with the logic of redistributing it to everybody.
Tommy's?
Well, the problem we're faced with right now is we have a group of permits, limited access permits, that regardless of whether in the sector or the common pool, they all have a PSC attached to them. And that PSC is basically a percentage of the available catch. And that PSC, when we started Amendment 16, there was a defined pool of permits that were eligible for these PSCs. And when you calculate them, they all add up to one. As permits, in some cases, get turned in and canceled, your totals no longer add up to one. And so far, it's just a small difference, but it doesn't add up. The percentages don't add up to 100%, or the total doesn't add up to one. So you wind up with, if you make the assumption that everybody were to join a sector and you didn't make any adjustment at all, you would be allocating something less than 100% of the available fish to the sector. And so what this does is it a rather simple calculation, it just adjusts everybody's PSC based on how much of the PSC has exited by permits of them turned away. And so I'm not sure this is exactly right the way the calculation's done, but it gives you a pretty close idea. You know, if 1% of the PSC leaves the fishery, then everybody else's permit goes up by 1%. All of their PSCs go up by 1%. The only it makes the calculation easier for the service so that our totals always add up to one, and we don't have any of these stocks with where we're not really allocating the whole stock out, where we've got some of it unallocated. In the absence of any guidance, I think what the service has been, from the council, what the service has been doing to date has been just what you said, which is putting that PSC into the common pool.
Anyone else on the council? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Last chance. Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Fifteen. Opposed? One. Motion carries 15-1. Frank?
Okay, that's it for that section. And can go back to the PowerPoint, and we'll have three more motions after that.
Okay, we're moving on to section 4.3 of the document, which is the commercial and recreational fishery measures. All of these have come to, well, at least the first two have come to the council before, so I'm not going to go into too much detail on them, but just to summarize, section 4.3.1 is a scallop dredge exemption in the Great South Channel area. You can see in the map on the board, there's currently a closure for general category scallop permits from June 1st to June 30th in the northern part of the closure, and from April 1st to June 30th in the southern part of the closure. This measure would exempt the exemption essentially and allow the scallops to dredge in that area during those closures. For impacts, there's marginal increases in yellowtail flounder discards are possible, and there could be adverse effects on spawning activity. A little bit uncertain. The next measure is 4.3.2, which is the Gulf of Maine spawning cod protection area. The committee selected proposed boundaries from four alternatives at their September meeting, and the final proposed boundary came before the council at the September meeting. And at the last committee meeting, the committee removed sub-option B that would have created a possession prohibition. So currently, the only option that remains in the document is a complete closure of this area. The committee also heard an overview of two informal informational meetings that were held in Portsmouth and Newburyport and were attended by several recreational fishermen. The comments included that other fishing should be allowed in the area, especially striper and shark fishing, that the closure should mimic the Mass Bay closure rules to make them more easily understandable to recreational fishermen who aren't used to having these types of closures. There was disagreement in the public over whether the lat long lines or whether Loran lines were more useful for compliance. And there was concern that part of the area of high spawning activity was not included in the boundaries of the closure. And there were also several comments that the timing was wrong. Some people said that it was too long and there was really only a 2 to 3 week spawning season there around Memorial Day. Some of the comments said that the season was too short and it should be a year-round closure. And some of the comments said that the proposed closure is too early and should be continued through at least the middle of July.
Bye.